Hello, and welcome to episode 16 of Virtually Relevant. I'm Eric.
This is Kevin.
Hey, I'm William.
We're going to go over some VR news, and then we're going to talk about panels and lens types used in virtual and augmented reality headsets, kind of compare and contrast them, talk about their history and where they're going. But first, let's pop into the news. One critical bit is Facebook appears to be narrowing and focusing their product line. They are retiring the Oculus Go. How do you guys feel about that?
Finally.
Kind of saw the writing on the wall with this one for a little while. Don't let the guys over or the people over at the subreddits hear you say this, because they vehemently still believe that the Gear VR is still a completely viable and totally good platform. And which for its time it was, but it's been abandoned for what now, 2 years?
Yeah.
And the Oculus Go seems to be going that direction as well. I'm glad that they're simplifying the lineup because there's less confusion. Also, 3DOF has very minimal use case to the consumer.
Exactly.
Right.
And it really only creates more brand confusion for them, I think. You know, having the Quest, which is that flexible Switch style headset, and the higher end desktop headset is I think the way to go for them. So I think it's a good choice.
Yeah, I think the era of 3DOF is over. I think 6DOF is just, it needs to be the baseline. And we talked a little bit in our last mini episode about the fact that the mid-generational update of the Quest may have something like a slimmed down model that just uses hand tracking without the controllers to support a lower price point to fill in kind mm-hmm. of where the Go used to sit. All right. That speculation, of course, but they clearly Quest is going to have to fill in for the low end as well as the high end. So it's just going to stretch in both directions. But I don't know that
it'll stretch, because I mean I think it'll just become the new baseline. Like,
yeah.
I mean, Kevin, you'll remember this pretty vividly because we're about the same age. Is, you know, when I was growing up, you know, the original Nintendo and then the Super Nintendo, and then you get to the 64 generation of consoles, and then all of a sudden all of those consoles had joysticks of some kind, right? So if you had a controller that didn't have joysticks, it was suddenly ill-equipped for the vast majority of experiences, for the vast majority of games. And I think the Go has kind of gone that direction. It's a controller without joysticks. You know, yeah, you can do some things, maybe not all things, but it's just really, it doesn't have what you need to fully take advantage of what you're working with.
I feel like the only real benefit of the Go was price.
Price. Yeah.
So that's why I'm saying stretch. It's going to either have to find some way to come in at a lower price point, or people are going to have to, I think, you know, $400 or $500 is a hard sell for purely a media consumption device.
Absolutely.
So I'm not sure exactly how they thread that needle, but unless they're planning to abandon a media platform, then they're going to have to find some way to make it work for the crowd that would have been buying an Oculus Go.
Maybe we'll see like a monthly rent to own type situation where
you
four easy payments of $99.99, and if you call now, you'll get a
free
second Oculus
shipping
Quest
and handling.
To go.
And maybe they'll make some changes, you know, to the mid-generational replacement that allows them to bring the baseline cost down. So who
right,
knows? We'll
right.
see. Speaking of the Quest, if you have firmware 18, in theory, you should have voice commands active if you toggle them on, allowing you to do things like starting casting or taking photos. There's a list of things that you can activate, you know, in experience using the voice commands. My headset updated to firmware 18, but has not given me that option. So I'm not quite sure whether there's a separate toggle that they're also rolling out on top of the firmware, but
right.
keep an eye
so
on.
So I wonder, is it like a keyword type voice command, like Oculus, you know, do this? You know,
that's a good question. I don't know, since I haven't gotten to play with it yet. I mean, I like the idea. It's certainly handy to be able to do things like start casting without having to mm-hmm. back out to the main menu. But I think there's, at least unless they've got some really clever use cases for it, I think that beyond the sort of basic functionality, there's probably not a ton of benefit to that.
And
Kevin, have you had something?
Have you dug into the settings to see if it's like a little, you know, beta option type thing?
I looked under the experimental features. Of course, I'm coming in through the new menu, the experimental menu, and maybe it's hidden somewhere different there. I checked the quick links, which is where they claimed it would be, that there'd be a little icon next to the microphone mute for voice commands, and I didn't see it there. And I didn't see it under experimental features, but may also require, with the hand tracking, even if it updated, it required an additional reboot. So maybe I just need to reboot it and see if it picks up. So, but we'll kick the tires on that and report back next episode if it's compelling or interesting beyond just kind of basic functionality.
And then another thing that I'm wondering is it actually done in the software on the Quest itself, or does it send it out, you know, wirelessly?
That is an excellent question. Certainly easy to test by turning off your Wi-Fi. I hope it processes it locally. They've certainly got the processing horsepower to do it, and there's no good excuse for sending your voice across the wire, but this is Facebook, so
because you know, to me, that's the thing with my phone and Bixby is it just sends everything, you know, to the cell tower. So it makes it so annoying trying to do stuff and or use it. So I don't really use it anymore, knowing that it has to, you know, connect in.
Yeah.
When I would think that it would have plenty of power to do it.
It should.
Considering
it should be entirely powerful enough to do its own voice recognition. Yeah, I was very disappointed that a lot of the personal assistants like you know, the Google Home or the or Amazon's Alexa did not process things locally. And I understand the benefits to them sending it across the wire.
Yeah.
But I have a level of discomfort with privacy concerns. And plus, it's just inefficient.
Exactly. So, that's my main thing is just why not do it there on the system when you know you have the power for it?
So, a drama I've been beating for a long time is I've always said that as great as the Quest is, it needs a competitor. And the biggest problem with getting a competitor up and going is a software ecosystem. There's competitive hardware out there like the Pico Neo i2 and so forth, but without a robust software ecosystem, it can't really compete. In good news, Qualcomm and HTC have partnered up, and they are now officially offering the Vive Wave platform to any Snapdragon-based headset. Now, that's probably a little grander than it actually is, because I don't think there is just a ton of content on the Wave platform. But at least it is a platform, and it's got a little bit of history, and it's attached to one of the major players. So I think that gives people a lot more confidence in building for that platform than if, say, you know, Pico had said, okay, we're, you know, building our own store in the U.S. That might be a harder sell for developers.
It's a little akin to saying, well, all Google Cardboard devices will have access to this.
Right.
Like, well, okay, but okay.
So, I mean, I guess the hope is that kind of like the Steam VR ecosystem now where, sure, you can pick up, you know, an HP Reverb, or you can pick up Valve Index or Vive Pro. You know, lots of manufacturers can build hardware, and you can pick the hardware that makes the most sense for you, and it'll all work with the software ecosystem. So you're not locked in to one piece of hardware or one or to the Oculus ecosystem. So I think that's potentially good news, but we'll just have to see how it plays out. They're going to have to, I think, seed the store pretty heavily. I think some bribes are in order to get some major developers to port maybe the 10 or 12 top titles that aren't exclusive to Oculus over to the Wave platform. I mean, it's got a... Ooh, that's right. Facebook bought Beat Saber, didn't they? Shoot.
Yes, they
did. That's a no-go now.
Mm-hmm.
Now that looks like a more clever move than I had originally given it credit for. That may have, in fact, been exactly why they did it.
Oh, I would not doubt that that's 100% why they did it, is if they control the, you know, the most popular game, the quote-unquote killer app for VR. Right. Like, I mean, of course. Now, the only thing is they can't put the genie back in the bottle with Beat Saber in the way of saying, oh, we're going to pull it off of Steam VR, or we're going to pull it off of all these other things. That just historically doesn't go well for them. But
you know, they can prevent it from coming to a new platform. You know,
exactly. So they can just say, no, we don't want to port that. We're not gonna bother.
Well,
so
here's hoping that
right.
That HTC and maybe some other major partners put up some cash to help developers port to Wave.
Right. And, I mean, don't get me wrong. There will absolutely be clones on the store, for sure. Yeah. But seeing the official Beat Saber game is unlikely. So I saw Google, you know, there was that thing about Google's volumetric VR video streaming. Yes. So they've got a not quite, what's the technology? Light field, light field, but it's some volumetric video, which that's, you know, we're stepping that direction to where, you know, instead of having just streaming 360 video, which is okay and has its use case and it's good for, you know, little things, but having some actual depth to things is just
right.
It's a whole nother level.
Yeah, I think the difference between feeling like you're watching a video and feeling like you're standing in a space is the ability to lean in or lean around, or you know, and to, you know, actually be able to see what's behind something. I think that makes a huge difference, and it doesn't feel like the entire world is bolted to your face.
Exactly, it's which like is a problem.
3DOF to 6DOF, just in a very limited space for video. The exciting parts about this are, up until recently, you know, light field video, any sort of volumetric video in VR, the data rates were punishing. They were staggering.
Right.
I mean, I downloaded a couple of demos from Google on Steam, and I mean, for extremely short video clips or for you know, stills even, I mean, these things were coming in at gigs and sometimes mini gigs. So being able to compress things down and find a more efficient way to encode and transfer these things to the point where, I mean, they're saying they're targeting, you know, they say streaming, they're targeting about 300 megabits per second, which most people don't have access to that, but some people do.
Right.
You know, if you have fiber to your house, or if you've got, you know, some of the top tiers on a cable modem, you absolutely can get that in major cities in certain markets.
Basically, if you can use Stadia, you're a potential option for this.
But
so
I mean,
I was looking through it, and so they're doing it through RGBA plus depth, which is red, green, blue, then alpha and depth channels. So they're actually doing they're putting it, the tech behind it is really kind of interesting. So it's more layers than are in your traditional video.
Yeah.
To accomplish this, so that it's almost like its own codec that they've designed for this.
Yes,
so
it very much
do
is.
Do you need a special viewer?
Yes,
absolutely. To watch it?
Okay. Yeah, because it's actually creating layers of very lightweight geometry, and then it's wrapping these on top of it with, you know, RGB and alpha, so that you can see through it. So it's a bit. I mean, think about a ViewMaster slide, but if each layer in the ViewMaster didn't have to be flat.
Right.
So, and you could move your head, you know, around so you could see what was behind a layer. So it's
like streaming a pop-up book.
Yeah, like streaming a pop-up book. But I mean, at least it's hard to tell from the example videos and the example, you know, if you go to their site for it, you can kind of deconstruct all the different parts of the process and see how each part works, and it's completely fascinating, and the end result is extremely credible looking on a flat screen. I would very much like to see it on a headset, and in their demo video they showed people doing it on a headset, so they've clearly reached the point where the tech is there. I guess they just aren't quite ready to share it. But you know, I think it would be, you know, this sort of tech is relatively lightweight, which means that, you know, the Quest should be able to do it. So you know, that's great for content on the Quest, and if they can get streaming working really well, you know, the idea of parking one of these things on the front row of a concert, or you know, on courtside at a basketball game, is suddenly very, very compelling.
Yeah.
The example rig that they're using for capture, captures about 220 degrees, so wide enough that, you know, if you look left and you look right, you're not going to find the edges, but you can't turn 180 degrees around and look behind you. But that's actually a pretty reasonable thing. That's, in most cases, that's what you're doing. But with 180, it's a little too easy to see the edges if you turn your head a little bit. And the rig that they put together with off-the-shelf components costs about $7,000, which for light field capture is actually phenomenal. I mean, it puts it out of the reach of all but the most well-heeled hobbyists, but any company that wanted to do it absolutely could. So
that's very cool.
Promising tech.
And so on the topic of Google, they just bought Focal, or well, they bought North,
right,
that makes the smart glasses, Focals. I went to go to look them up because I hadn't heard of them, and Google wiped their website out, it looks
Wow.
Like it's just a page that says, you know, Focals, and it says, you know, that it's a smart glass platform basically, and then that's it. There's a button for refunds, I guess, for people who had ordered who are now no longer going to be getting them. And that's it. Like, there's no information about it. It's kind of weird. I've never really thought to look it up about, you know, what happens when Google buys a company, but if this is what happens, that's pretty nuts.
Well, to be fair to both Google and North, they
right.
are giving full refunds to anybody who pre-ordered.
Right, absolutely.
So.
Which is good. I
yes.
mean, I would be super upset if, you know, you had bought it or I don't know if this one went through a Kickstarter, but kickstarted it and all of a sudden,
right.
Oh, well, now you don't get it. But there is still an article up on The Verge that explains, you know, what it is and what it does. And they put it akin to a smartwatch on your face,
gotcha.
Which, you know, makes sense. That's kind of what I've been expecting to see in that kind of a form factor, is links up to your, you know, your phone and
right.
gives you a quick access to information. That's the reason I have a smartwatch. You know, I love being able to just go, oh, who's calling me? I don't have to pull my phone out of my pocket. I can just look down. Ah, I don't really care.
Right. And Google went this direction with Google Glass. So a more capable Google Glass that ideally avoided some of the privacy concerns could be a good move. But
right.
Sort of an intermediate thing between, I mean, not full on AR, but as you said, having access to all the functions of your phone without having to pull it out of your pocket.
Right.
So that's kind of more of just like a heads up display.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
So I think that's probably the direction they're going there. We talked a little bit in the past episode about the Catwalk C Kickstarter. Which is their,
doing very well, one. Apparently.
It is. It is getting a lot of backing. So
it's all thanks to our coverage here.
Totally. 100%.
You're welcome, Cat.
But we will see. I will be very curious to all of these sorts of locomotion solutions in the past. I've seen that they kickstarted a price, and then as soon as the Kickstarter ends, the price for the general public starts rising dramatically. And
right.
sometimes the Kickstarters get delivered, and sometimes they don't. So
Frequently they don't.
Very frequently they don't. And even in some cases, when some of them get delivered, not all of them get delivered. That's been an unfortunate
right.
case. But all four people experimenting with locomotion solutions. I haven't found this category of locomotion solution to be ideal for me, but I haven't seen a silver bullet yet. So everybody gets to pick the sets of trade-offs that they're willing to work with, and this may well be the right one for many people. So.
Yeah, and it looks like it has a decent amount of support that they're going to be putting into it, because of course that was another big thing with the treadmills and everything like that, is, you know, people got these in their hands and then they had to pretty much do all their own coding for it if they
right.
wanted
yeah.
to work on anything. But they got a pretty decent little list of stuff that it looks like they're working on. So it'll actually be able to support quite a few big games whenever it comes out.
I'll be keen to try one. So I have not tried the Catwalk, although it seems very similar to the Omni as far as the basic
yeah.
mechanics. So Apple is poaching some of the... It has been the lead contender in poaching ex-Magic Leap employees. Magic Leap did manage to get another round of funding and stay afloat, but they laid off about 600 employees. And
it was like half their workforce or something, right?
It was a high percentage. But a lot of those people now have Apple on their LinkedIn page. And we're assuming that the AR division is siphoning up absolutely all the free expertise in the market.
So less poaching and more scavenging.
Yeah, scavenging. That's true. Yeah, no, I mean, they were no longer working for Magic Leap at the time. So yeah, totally. It's scavenging. It's not poaching. But yeah. It goes to show that Apple is dead serious. And they are... they're running as hard and as fast as they can towards the finish line on AR glasses. And I hope they nail it, because we need credible AR glasses. I don't think we've had those yet in the consumer market.
Nope, not really. The closest thing I think we got, well, I guess depends. Nreal.
Yeah, that's true.
And not quite, but... you know, a little older, we had the snap glasses that were like the glorified camera.
Right. So. I'll throw one more Kickstarter out there. Yaw VR is shipping. They've shipped to a number of people, and mine is actually en route now. So hopefully within about a month, I will have a Yaw VR to play with. It is a motion platform. It's basically a bowl that you sit in that has motorized treads underneath it that can rotate it and shift it in all directions. And it will feed into any piece of software that that feeds out data on orientation and velocity and so forth, which flight simulators, racing rigs, and roller coaster sims and so on often do, because people will build their own motion platforms for them. So it'll have a decent amount of VR software out there that'll support it. Things like Elite Dangerous and Assetto Corso and so on. But it will probably remain limited to just those that do that. It looks very cool. It's priced well for what it is. It's lightweight. I think it's under 50 pounds. It's compact. You can flip the bowl on top of the mechanics and slide the whole thing under a desk. I don't know whether it will be as compelling in person as it looks in video, but I hope to find out in about a month.
That'll be awesome.
I will say things kind of take another turn whenever you have your view obstructed and just the slightest bit of movement can be multiplied from what you're seeing. So if you remember the Jurassic Park ride at Dave and Buster's.
Yes.
You know, like at the very end there, the chairs weren't leaning all that much, but you know, it pretty much felt like you were, you know, 90 degrees to the floor. So
yeah. No, that is true. And that's a trick that you've seen done in a number of places. You can move part way and then visually go further and get the same, your brain will believe it. Although it was interesting watching some of the videos for Yaw VR, I saw the opposite thing happening where, you know, they were doing a roller coaster sim and they actually kept turning further. I mean, it was the turn duration was the same amount of time, but they actually physically turned further than they did in the game. I guess to give a stronger sense of the motion. I don't know. It's probably gonna be interesting to watch. But yeah, the motion and the vision don't necessarily have to match up entirely. Although you start playing a little bit of a dangerous game there. If you get too decoupled, or if you get conflicting information, then that can lead to nausea. So, but anyway, very hyped to try that. So let's get into our primary deep dive for this evening. We're going to be talking about the, you know, display tech, the different types of panels that can be in VR and AR glasses, and to a lesser extent, the types of lenses that get paired with those. Let's start off a little bit with OLED, and the notable thing about OLED is that it was the second display tech that was used in VR, in modern VR. But it was the one that sort of exploded and was used in everything for a while. Do you guys want to...
For those who don't know, OLED is organic LED. So years and years and years ago, if you had a device that was a monochrome display, so just like black and white, chances are it was, and white being lit up, black being nothing. A lot of MP3 players in the late 2000s had these. Chances are that was an OLED display. They've come a long way. Now there are TVs that are full RGB OLED. So just for the uninitiated, OLED is an alternative to LCD. But the pros being you get blacker blacks because it's not, correct me if I'm wrong, but an LCD, you're still backlit.
Yeah, correct.
Right? So with the OLED, you're actually lighting it on a per pixel basis rather than a full backlit.
Right. The pixels themselves emit light as opposed to allowing light through from a backlight.
Right. So OLED, organic liquid, organic light emitting diode.
Right.
LCD, liquid crystal display. So that's what's going to give you that difference between, you know, your dark colors versus your lights.
Oculus was the one that kind of pioneered the use of OLEDs in VR. When they went from their first developer kit to their second developer kit, they jumped from LCD to OLED. And there were a number of reasons for that at the time. The primary one was that LCDs that were on the market at the time did not have fast enough switching times.
Right.
So you ended up with very bad ghosting and blur and so forth. And there were challenges to getting pulsed backlighting to they did what they call low persistence display, so you didn't get the blur. OLED solved a lot of those things. They were excited about the possibility of darker blacks and, you know, brighter displays, richer colors. The negatives they knew about initially were cost. OLEDs are expensive and difficult to produce. And there's also some things about the way you have to arrange the routing information on it that causes it to typically have wider gaps between the pixels. So a little bit more obvious screen door effect. And it's difficult to do an RGB stripe arrangement. Most of them are pentile. Right. So, but they also discovered that there were additional negatives they hadn't anticipated. The biggest one of those is true black smearing. Mm-hmm. Do you guys want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So with true black smearing, basically what the problem was is even though OLEDs were very fast at switching colors, they had a bit of delay if they were turning from completely off or black to a color. So basically what you would start having is if you had an image in your display that was completely black, as you moved your head, you would get a kind of a black ghosting image kind of smearing across the screen. So they also called it black smear was the common term for it.
I usually experienced it as a sort of like a wobbliness on the edge of shadows. It looked like jello. It would kind of wobble as you moved.
Yeah. Because as soon as you stop, it seemed like the shadow of it kind of caught back to it.
Right.
So,
which coincidentally was one of the things, it became really noticeable around the time of the DK2 and the CV1 because horror games became like the go-to. And what do you have in horror games? A lot of dark environments. So you ended up, it was the worst case scenario for this issue because instead of being in the bright lit, area like the Tuscany Villa demo that they had, now you're in, you know, this dark hallway, and the second you get something that's lit up in that area and you're walking through, now this effect is super noticeable to the user.
And this was a challenge for everybody. Pretty much everyone followed Oculus's lead at the time.
Right.
Vive, you know, used OLEDs, and, you know, quite a lot of the competing headsets did. But the cost and the production complications and the true black smearing were kind of... that was a lot to overcome. And what they ended up doing to compensate to avoid true black smearing was they just never let you turn the pixels completely off, which completely eliminated the benefit of true black. So you had true dark gray all the time, which was kind of what you got with LCD anyway. And over time, As they realized that there was demand for it, they started making LCDs with faster switching times and faster refresh rates and so forth. And so suddenly a lot of the reasons to go OLED disappeared, especially as they got LCD tech that had better pixel fill, where there wasn't as much of a gap between the pixels. And it's much easier to produce LCDs that have RGB stripe, which is the preferred layout typically. So you started seeing people jumping back the other direction and going to LCD. And in general, results the response has been pretty positive. The Rift S jumped to LCD. And a lot of the, let's see, the Reverb 2 is an LCD. We're seeing those coming in, and I think the consensus is that that's probably the smart way to go. So this is kind of a return back to from whence we came. And there's ways to compensate for some of LCD's shortcomings. Certainly the pulsed backlight avoids the ghosting that we had in the past. The refresh rates are now, you can get them all the way up to, you know, 120 or 144. That's entirely doable on LCD. And the narrower color gamut can be compensated for by QLED.
On QLED, it's really essentially a LCD display. It's right. Just they have extra like chemicals and little extra additives to get them a little bit brighter for the better colors. And as Eric mentioned, they also put basically like these little kind of dots over the pixels that kind of they kind of act like diffusers a little bit to kind of spread the light out a little bit more. So you wouldn't quite get that that screen door effect as much with QLEDs, but that I know of, no one is really looking at QLEDs for headset displays. They're just on TVs right now.
Right. I haven't seen anyone go that direction yet. Although, you know, it's certainly a direction that they could choose to go.
Right. Most of your modern TVs right now are going to be like either OLED or QLED panels.
Right, that's becoming common.
Such quality out of it.
Going an entirely different direction, and something we do see in a handful of headsets are micro displays, which are fundamentally different. They're actually manufactured using the same tech, the sort of microlithography tech that they use to fab chips. So they're The positive is they can have extremely high pixel densities. The negatives are that, much like chips, scaling them up beyond a certain size become prohibitively expensive because there's always flaws on the wafer. And the bigger it is, the more likely it is to have a flaw. And if it has a flaw, you got to throw the whole thing out. So,
You can only get certain chunks.
Right.
Right. You're not going to get, if you have a smaller range of needing to have a certain range of perfect, you know, rectangular perfect pixels, you know, you're only going to get that so many times out of a wafer. And if you need bigger, you know, obviously that's, you're only going to get A, you're going to get fewer out of a wafer, and B, any issue means that you're now going to get even less out of a wafer. So it's, like you said, it's prohibitively expensive.
The biggest challenge with micro displays, as appealing as they are, because their power draw is extremely low, they're extremely compact, they're extremely lightweight, which all sounds perfect for VR headsets. The negative is that with this tiny display, blowing it up to a reasonable size becomes very challenging. So traditionally, they've always said, you can't get them up to the 90 to 100 degree field of view that you want, at least not without some extreme distortion, especially at the edges. There are some people who have played some games. I believe Panasonic has gotten something that's up above 90 degrees field of view. What are the name of those glasses that are coming up? The ones they showed prototypes of. God.
They're the steampunk ones. It was something super simple.
Anyway, they have been used in prototypes for VR headsets. And they've also been integrated into more advanced headsets, such as the Vario. The Vario uses...
they just call it Panasonic VR glasses.
Oh, is that really all they're calling it? Really? Okay, fair enough.
I guess that's why we couldn't remember what it was.
Why it was not a memorable one.
I'm looking for here. Yeah, I think it's just... So they're actually using micro OLEDs.
Oh, are they really? Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
But yeah, they didn't... Apparently there's no name for them. They're just Panasonic... VR glasses.
Fair enough. With Vario, they got around the field of view issue by using a traditional panel for the wide field of view and then just overlaying the micro displays via a half silvered angled mirror onto the center of the display. So there's an area in the center of your field of view that is much higher resolution than the surrounding area, which is a very cool hack, although it means you've got, you know, up to four displays in the headset and significantly higher GPU requirements to drive it.
Right.
So
it also, I will say from personal experience, there is definitely a line that you can see.
Yes.
It's not super distracting, but it is there. So, you know, if the hope is that it's virtually, you know, that foveated rendering style, right, where it's virtually, you know, imperceptible. It's not that, but it is a good effect of having high density, high quality visuals in the center of your view. That being said, it is in the center of your view. It doesn't follow your gaze, so you do have to, you do have to kind of move your head to get that where you want it, which it's kind of natural if you're an early VR adapter, because we were doing that a lot, you know, back in the day. But if you came into it on the CV1 or the Quest, it's going to feel strange to you.
Yeah. And they did make some strides in reducing the visibility of that seam between the two techs in their second generation headsets. But that's still sort of boutique tech. It's for, you know, expensive headsets and so forth. There are some interesting things being done with micro displays and folded optics or pancake optics. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but they may end up jumping into the forefront depending on the exact course that optics take in VR headsets.
Right. And with everything here, the important part is the optics plus the panel. And we can get into that, but that's the correlation. Is you can have, you know, the best LCD out there, but it's not going to do you any good if you don't have good optics to help, you know, get that field of view and really make use of that. And there's some interesting ones, like we said. I'll jump on waveguides.
Yes,
are something that we've seen a couple of times now. Magic Leap is the big one, right?
Sure.
Essentially, what it's doing is it's multiple different paths for the light, and then it's directing that light to form the image. Now, that's not the same as what they originally were doing, right? They had the big, giant thing bolted to the table that they were doing.
They called it chip photonics, and they were talking about
engineering the light.
But yeah, they had a table-mounted prototype that blew everyone away, and that they swore they could miniaturize, and they couldn't. So they fell back to using waveguides, which is the same tech that like the HoloLens uses.
Right.
They did do some clever things having multiple layers, so they had multiple focal distances that were correctly set up. But in general, that's the thing. The big benefits on waveguides are that they're extremely thin and lightweight. You can place them very close to the eye, and you can make them clear so that real world light passes through for an augmented reality display. The biggest negatives are that it's very, very difficult to get a very wide field of view in that.
Right.
Most things are using waveguides typically are between 40 and 50 degree field of view, and you really need to be up above 90, ideally close to 100, if you're going to be competitive with modern VR headsets.
For those of you who haven't used either of those headsets, your field of view is basically like holding a book in front of your face at an arm's length. That's essentially your field of view for the augmented world. It's very small compared to any of the consumer VR headsets. So it's not exactly the best option.
Right. I mean,
you were saying the other option.
trying very, very hard to extend that and widen it. And I mean, yeah, they made some progress between the HoloLens 1 and the HoloLens 2, but it's still not competing in the same class as VR headsets on field of view, especially as VR headsets are looking to get even wider. Yeah. The other negative is that with traditional waveguides, you can only do one frequency of light per layer, which means that you end up with color registration issues. So you've got a red layer, a green layer, and a blue layer, and they don't always line up perfectly if they're being activated in sequence. So you get kind of a color ghosting as you move your head around. There's been some advances on being able to channel two colors on one layer, but really you got to have three if you want the color registration to show up perfectly. So
right,
that's the big challenge with waveguides. As promising as they are, the barriers to making that the mainstream tech have so far resisted, even the heavy hitters. So it is currently the state of the art for AR classes that we know of. We don't know the tech that's being used by Apple, but in the VR side, waveguides are probably a no-go because of the field of view issue.
Yeah. Well, if Apple's track record sticks around, then we'll probably see it about 3 to 5 years after it's released by another company.
Right. That's the traditional thing. The other option to get the panel much closer to your eyes is what they call pancake optics, where you layer lenses, and each layer is half silvered and polarized. So the light travels between the first lens and the second lens, bounces back, reflects off the front side of the first lens, and passes through the second lens because now it's polarized a different direction. And what all that buys you is all that travel distance that it covered multiple times gives you effectively is the same effect as having more distance between the lens and the screen. So you can put the screen very close to this compound layered lens and have it, focus properly, which is phenomenal. But the negative is every time it bounces, it loses 50% of its light. So the more you fold space, the more you lose light. So if you were, if you only had, two layers to it, then you would end up with 25% of the light that you started out with. And it's going to have it for each layer you add onto that. So it's very, very difficult to get a display bright enough to survive that. And it's also, wasteful. You're generating a lot of light and a lot of heat that's just getting thrown away in the bounces. But there are some clever things being done. And actually the most interesting bit that we're seeing is Facebook just announced a prototype they've been playing with internally that's using the same type of folded optics, but instead of using lenses, it uses holographic film. And they're feeding it with lasers. So the lasers get past the brightness issue, and the pancake optics being done by holographic film gets it, very compact. Not quite as compact as waveguide. I think they're saying, 9 millimeters? But certainly these are sunglasses form factors. I mean, it's a form factor where you could put a pair of glasses on your face, and it's not this big front-heavy, bulky box strapped to your face.
Yeah. Talking Coke bottle glasses, but...
Right. They're still thick glasses. Still doable. But they're glasses. Now, to be clear, this is very, very much in the lab prototype tech. The prototype that they were showing off was monochrome. It was green only. They do have a full color display, but it is bolted to a table. How does that sound familiar? The hope is, again, that tech can be miniaturized and made to work in a pair of glasses. Will that happen? We don't know. If they do get it to happen, that's phenomenal. That's a great form factor. And with the lasers, they actually can get a significantly wider color gamut. They can get, a brighter display, even with the fall off from the folded optics. But this is significantly out there kind of tech. They are playing with the absolute boundaries of what anybody has really attempted. Exciting and cool, but no way guaranteed to make it into a headset anytime soon.
And then another kind of panel that's kind of on the horizon But right now they are still very expensive, is there's mini and micro LEDs. I forgot which one of the two it is exactly. One of the problems of LEDs is they have a physical size limit of how small they could actually get and continue to work. But with the mini or the micro LED, it could get down to a tenth of a millimeter in size and still work. So this is a possibility of something on the horizon of a panel type that could be seen in headsets. And it will have some of those benefits of OLED basically being to, you know, if that pixel is not in use, then it can just turn off and you know, you've got that pure black.
Right.
Now, I'm not too sure. I haven't heard anything yet about how fast those will be able to turn on and off. I'm guessing it won't really be a problem. Because with this, it's, you know, you'll have kind of like LCDs, you'll actually have the individual colors of red, green, blue just themselves. So they just have to turn on themselves. So that's something that we'll need to keep an eye on for the future as well.
Odds are there's probably other display tech that's showing up in labs. The demand is clearly there, especially for, you know, AR, something where you can pass through light. So they're aware that that's a huge market, and I'm sure a lot of R&D is being done. We may or may not see some of this tech before it, you know, gets announced as part of a product. Facebook has been honestly surprisingly open with a lot of its R&D, although it's hard to know which pieces they're keeping under wraps. But it's definitely exciting to see what is being played with in the lab. I guess we'll talk just a little bit about variable depth of focus since we're talking, you know, lenses. There have been the half dome prototypes have played with lenses that allow you to actually change the depth of focus. So when you focus close up, your eye flexes the lens to bring it into focus versus, you know, looking at a distance. And that is something that traditional VR tech has been unable to replicate. The first half dome prototype had lenses that were on rails with motors that actually shifted them forward and back based on gaze tracking to adjust the focus to the thing you're focusing on, which is very clever, but also it's mechanical, it's loud, it consumes a lot of power, it's a lot of moving parts. Then they shifted to some tech where they actually layered individual focal elements that they could turn on and off to adjust the depth of focus, which made it much more compact, much lighter weight, removed the mechanical component of it, and hopefully made it a lot more feasible for real-world tech. And that's pretty independent of display type. You could probably layer that on almost anything, although, you know, certain intersections with, like, folded optics and so on might get a little challenging. So, interesting tech there. But that's, I think, pretty much the gamut of what we know about in VR and AR display tech.
Did we talk about the hexagonal?
No, we didn't.
Remember, there was the one the
crazy
company,
lenses.
Was that French
the
company?
Weird.
Was it
bonkers
Link?
One?
Maybe.
There is a company out there, and Eric, if you want to look this up in the background while we're doing this, so there was a company out there that what they were doing is they were taking a traditional LCD, I believe it was, but it's shaped funky. It's like hexagonal shape. And what they're doing in order to make this work and give you a really big field of view is they're using the same tech that we talked about before, which is the essentially mirrored mirrored lenses, or they're strange shaped lenses. They're octagonal or hexagonal shaped lenses that, you know, flip the image and bend it. So it sort of curves around your field of view. So it's one, something that's unlike any of the ones we've talked about. It's a really ambitious thing, and supposedly it works really well.
It's a deeply weird form factor for the lens.
It is funky.
Yeah, they actually they pour and it was Lynx. It was Lynx.
LYNX.
Right? The Lynx R1. It's out of France. Yeah. But they pour this very thick, very oddly shaped lens for each one.
And it's like it's an acrylic lens.
It's acrylic. Yeah. The thing that's really weird about it is that it actually has a dead spot in the center. Because it focuses in from all four sides, it fills in your whole field of view, but there's actually a hole right in the middle of it, which is phenomenal for eye tracking, because traditionally you have to park an eye tracking camera off to the side, which introduces some distortion and some problems in focusing. The fact that they can actually potentially park a camera directly in front of your pupil is very cool. But right. It's unusual tech, and it's very, very intriguing. But we have not yet seen that in a commercially shipped product, although I think they are supposed to ship this year, are they not? Let me see.
Yeah, so the light folding optics are what they're calling them. 90 degree by 90 degree at 90 hertz for supposedly AR and VR. It's pass-through AR, I believe. It could actually be just... Well, I think it's pass-through, actually, now that I'm looking at it. But yeah, so if you're interested and you're listening to this and you're like, what are they talking about? This is insane. Yeah, it kind of is. But go look. Look up the Lynx LYNX R1 headset. VR Scout did an article. I think Road to VR did an article. Upload VR did an article. Apparently, it's $1,500, so not as expensive as, say, the... what's the one, the XR1?
From Vario. Yeah.
Vario.
Yeah.
Not as expensive as some of those. Obviously, you're not getting the same micro display, hyper, clear technology, but definitely a different approach to it, and really unlike what we've talked about so far. There's a really good picture on Upload VR's article of what the lens looks like. It's really crazy, but definitely an interesting technique.
It basically looks like a cut gemstone.
Yes. Right. It very much looks like a diamond. And how that one will play out, we'll find out at some point.
And by the way, that does actually, it's at least it's announced to have eye tracking. So they did in fact park eye tracking camera in the center. That's a price point. It's not, you know, consumer pricing, but
it's definitely prosumer
price. Yeah, prosumer and small business pricing.
Yeah.
The big benefit is that the optics allow the screens to be much closer to your eyes, so it's more compact and lightweight, which is very attractive. But we will see. It was supposed to ship summer of 2020, but I'm assuming that the COVID shutdowns in China probably threw a bit of a wrench into that timeline. Assuming they were going to meet it. So I guess we'll just have to see how that plays out and when it hits the market, but very, very keen to actually try it.
Okay. Well, I think we've talked about everything, like you said, adding on that one little weird one, but yeah, as you can tell from what we've talked about in this episode today, optics are wide ranging, and we've grown a lot in the last, let's see, it's 2020. So 4 years. 4 years since the release of the Rift, and almost 7 since the Oculus Rift Kickstarter. So, there's been a lot of change. There's been a lot of growth in terms of the display tech, from, you know, using phone displays now to custom made panels specifically for VR and custom made optics specifically for VR. So, VR and AR to say.
Right.
We've seen a lot of growth, and I'm really interested to see what the next like big step is for optics, because I know that's kind of what everybody chases, is like, oh, you know, how do we get better visuals? And to some degree, yes, you know, visuals are important. There are other factors that really help with your immersion, but
right.
once you've got human eye resolution and or even just human eye FOV, it's going to be, you know, it's fantastic. So we'll keep watching this. And as there's more, maybe we'll do an updated one of this in a couple of years and see, you know, where things have gone. So,
yeah, there was certainly a reason why it was weird in the beginning, but Facebook, after they got Oculus, if you went and looked at their job listings back when Facebook bought Oculus, there were mm-hmm. job listings for, like, you know, expert glass makers, scientists that had nothing to do except for just like the study of the eye and how they worked, back into like how the brain perceived images. Like, they were super deep into all this, and it's a good thing they were, because they definitely saw something very early on that they really needed to focus on. So, and I'm guessing that if you went and looked at the Oculus job listings now, you'd probably still see some of them around.
Oh, but certainly,
it was crazy the amount of just really weird and odd kind of things that you wouldn't really think of, you know, that they were hiring for.
No, it's interesting, because optics was one of those fields of tech that had largely stagnated. I mean, almost all of the great discoveries in optics, you know, it happened, you know, 50, 100 or more years ago. And I mean, you know, you saw refinements and tweaks and some minor adjustments, but nobody was really trying to do something revolutionary in the consumer space with optics. And that has absolutely changed. People are trying almost anything and are pushing in really fascinating directions. So exciting moment for the world of optics. Hopefully there's some knock-on benefits to anything we learn in VR that can be applied to other things as well.
Optics and displays.
Yes, definitely. All right. Well, thank you for joining us. Everybody stay safe and hope that your summer is going well.
See you, everyone.
Have a good one. We'll see y'all next time. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Virtually Relevant. If you liked it, please consider rating and reviewing us on your favorite podcast app. It helps bring us up in the charts and makes us easier to find. If you'd like to support Houston VR and this podcast, please consider becoming a Patreon member at patreon.com/HoustonVR. Until next time, thanks for listening.